Howdy folks, Kevin here. You haven't heard much from me recently, and that trend continues this week. But first, I want to let you know that the Naked Pravda is going on a brief summer break for the next few weeks, so don't panic or sell the farm when you don't see a new episode next week. Rest assured, we'll be back. And now, on with the show.
Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, the West has imposed over 16,000 sanctions on Russia, intending to cripple the economy driving the Kremlin's war machine. In addition to cutting Russia off from the SWIFT banking system, Western sanctions have also attempted to dry up the Kremlin's critical revenue streams by reducing European imports on Russian crude oil and gas, and imposing an international price cap on oil. In response, Russia has managed to circumvent many of these sanctions by finding new markets for its energy exports willing to sidestep Western sanctions. Its new buyers, countries like China and India, might have plugged a few holes in the Kremlin's leaky war chest, but they certainly don't bring Russia the kind of cash it used to get from oil sales before the war. Just last month, Russian state-owned energy giant Gazprom reported a net loss of $6.8 billion in 2023, and its parent company reported a net loss of $4.8 billion in the first quarter of 2024 alone. A recent Financial Times article details Putin's recent visit to China and provide some insight on how Russia plans to make up for such hefty losses in energy revenue by striking a deal with China to build the Power of Siberia 2, a proposed gas pipeline that would provide Gazprom with an alternative route to sell its gas following the sharp decline in energy sales due to sanctions. The article emphasized the Kremlin's limited bargaining power in these negotiations, leading the deal to stall out, which could have potentially dire consequences for Russia's long-term economic health. This more nuanced look at the Kremlin's diplomatic and economic wartime maneuverings, however, contradicts its own portrayal of Russia as a country thriving in the face of Western sanctions. And well, on the surface, Russia's wartime economy has proven to be surprisingly resilient, with the IMF estimating that Russia's GDP grew by 3.5% in 2023 and will continue to grow by 3.2% in 2024. So how can we reconcile these two vastly different images being painted of Russia's economy? And although the Russian economy didn't collapse from sanctions, as many economists had previously predicted it would, what effect have sanctions had on Russia's economy? And what are the longer-term effects that the Kremlin's wartime economic policies might have on the Russian people themselves? I'm Nastya Magera, an intern at Medusa, and this week I spoke with one of the authors of the Financial Times article I mentioned earlier, Anastasia Stugniy, to explore these questions in this episode of The Naked Pravda.
My name is Anastasia Stugniy. I work as a reporter for the Financial Times covering Russia, and I focus on macroeconomic issues, energy, and finance.
When the West first imposed sanctions on Russia after its 2022 invasion of Ukraine, many economists predicted that the Russian economy would just collapse because of sanctions. Can you explain a bit about why it didn't pan out the way people had anticipated, and how the Kremlin has managed to keep the Russian economy afloat despite such heavy costs of war and such stringent sanction regimes?
I think the anticipation of the Russian economy collapsing was slightly unrealistic from the very beginning, and we also expected the sanctions to hit harder and the economy to struggle more. But at the same time, we remember the 90s, and I'm not old, but I'm old enough to remember the 90s when the economy was actually collapsing. So compared to that, what is happening in Russian economy now is, of course, much better. But I think it's slightly more appropriate to talk about the sanctions and the idea of pressure on Russia through the scope of Russia getting less revenue and, as a result, spending less on the war. Because I think, to be honest, that there is this widespread misconception of the expected effect of sanctions. So it was not really to make the Russian economy collapse, simply because it's impossible, at least in a short-term perspective, I don't think it was possible, but to cut it off from the main streams of revenue, which didn't really happen. So the sanctions had certain effect, but they didn't cripple the economy. So why didn't it fail? I think it's a combination of factors. So first, Russia amassed vast resources and vast savings before the war. So Russia has this rainy day fund called National Wealth Fund. And Russia has been putting all the so-called extra energy revenues, which means Russia has the idea of baseline energy revenues it wants to receive throughout the year. And if it receives more, all the surplus is not spent straight away. It goes to this rainy day fund. And it was introduced after the previous crisis, because the previous rainy day fund was spent during the crisis in 2008. So Russia created the new one. And it had really strict policy. And in general, Russian fiscal policy was pretty strict and it was focused on saving. And I remember even economists joking, like, what is he saving for? What is in his mind? Because it's not like people in Russia were living a dream. It's not like the wages were high. It's not like the infrastructure was amazing. No. But at the same time, the money from this fund was not spent. So it was amassing the resources. But to be honest, the majority of people who looked at it, including myself, thought it was just, you know, some result of a trauma of the previous crisis or just some rigid strategy. But actually, it paid off. So first of all, despite the West freezing the central bank reserves, Russia still has quite a lot of money in liquid form in this rainy day fund. That's one thing. The second thing is that Russia didn't lose much of its revenue. It lost some, and it was, I think it was the hardest so far in the end of 2022 and in the beginning of 2023, when the oil price cap first started to work. But at the same time, like Russia, if you imagine Russian economy as a company, right, with a balance sheet. So on the one side of this balance sheet, you have the spending, which is ever growing because of the war and because of Putin's social promises. But on the other side, you have the revenues, right? So Russia has energy revenues and non-energy revenues. And non-energy revenues actually constitute the biggest part of it. So basically, the sanctions affected only one part of the revenues side of the balance sheet. So there was never hope that Russia would lose all the income in total. But it started working, and it worked mostly through the spread between the market price for oil and the Russian oil. But as Russia learned to navigate the situation better, as it established relationship with the new buyers, and also as it assembled its own shadow fleet, there is a lot written about shadow fleet. So more Russia adjusted to the new reality, lower the spread was. And now we're actually observing the situation when Russian oil and gas revenues, it's mostly oil, but they are growing at incredible speed. So Russia so far received 80% more in energy revenues than the last year. And this is mostly due to, on the one hand, higher prices in general in the economy because Brent price is soaring, but at the same time, due to lower spread to this Brent price. There are also some changes in the way the government taxes all companies, basically. So now the volume of the export doesn't matter. It's only the price, and the price is more or less fixed. So this is also part of the reason why the budget energy revenues are growing, but it's not the only reason. And here we come to one of the last explanations why sanctions on the Russian economy was not as hurtful as we or many would wish. So the reason is that the world is big and not all the companies, not all the countries joined the sanctions club, and specifically the main new buyers of the Russian oil. So before the war, Russia used to sell most of its oil to Europe. Now it sells most of its oil to China and India. And it didn't sell any oil to India before at all, like maybe a few barrels, experimental batch, but that's it. So now these are China and India. And even though the West has been somewhat efficient in imposing secondary sanctions on some sectors of so-called third countries, those who did not impose sanctions themselves, for example, if we talk about financing, about banks, it has been efficient. But when we talk about state level, so for example, Chinese state buying oil or Indian state buying oil, these are big countries with a huge influence in the region. So they just do not care much about it, which means Russia keeps selling to them, which means Russia keeps receiving those revenues. When we talk about gas, it has been a disaster for Russia, and specifically for Gazprom, its Russian main and only gas export company, because Russia exports most of its gas through pipelines, not through LNG, and the LNG technology is quite underdeveloped. So Gazprom has historically had a monopoly on the gas exports through pipeline, right? And most of the pipeline gas used to go to Europe. So Russia has been selling some to China, but even now when it operates at full, still the proportion is incomparable. So that's one thing. And then another part of the expenses side of the spreadsheet are the non-energy revenues. So basically internal revenues, mostly taxes on the Russians, people, retail investor and such, and the companies. And there also there was growth. So initially it was quite unclear where is it going, because when the sanctions hit first and when Russia first realized the level of isolation, of course, everything slowed down and it was hard for the companies and for people, you know, to pivot towards other suppliers, towards other sources of import, or in general to realize that this isolation is not temporary thing, but a new reality. To be honest, sometimes I feel that Russian economy finally got an idea, because, you know, and I hate mirroring Putin's rhetoric and that, because he always says that the sanctions helped Russia, which is never true, but still, that before the war, Russian economy was in some magical sleep, as if, you know, this sleeping beauty. So it has money, it somehow works, but the growth is super slow. The investment is low. It's just not clear where is it heading and what's happening with it. And now when isolation happened, when Russia started the war, it finally got the idea. Okay, so we're this, you know, we're fighting against the whole world. We're looking for new friends in the so-called global south. And we're about by ourselves. And it gave the state a certain idea of how they should frame their policy. It gave the businesses and people a certain idea of how to operate. So somehow just overall feeling of the Russian economy has changed. So now it is focused on one idea, whether it's good or not, where does it lead, how sustainable is the strategy? That's another question. But now it's somehow focused and it's moving in comparison to what it was before. So anyway, so now those non-energy revenues are also growing, even though not at the speed of energy revenues. So compared year on year, the first half of 2024, they grew by 40%, which is also a substantial growth. And this is driven mostly by the fact that economy is growing and the fact that there is more money in the economy. And the reason why there is more money in the economy is because of the other side of the spreadsheet, which is spending. So Russian economy has always been, like modern Russian economy, especially in the last 20 years, has been centralized, quite centralized. It called itself a market economy, but to be honest, it has never been purely market economy. So Russia is spending more and more every year. The balance sheet has been positive for many years, but since lately, it has been negative. It's a small deficit. It's about 1% of GDP so far. But still, it shows that Russia switched from this very rigid fiscal policy to the policy of spending. And of course, most of its spending, if not all, is somewhat associated with the military needs. And some of this money is counterproductive, we can say, because it becomes a tank, which then drowns in a swamp somewhere near Bakhmut. But some of this money works differently. So, for example, if a soldier who previously worked as a janitor now gets 10 times more and he gives this money to his family, it means that his wife can spend more on manicure or, I don't know, buy video games, whatever she likes. She spends more on groceries. She can send her children to a private school, which means that there is a need for a private school in the middle of nowhere where there was never a need for a private school, really. So this means that there is this huge stimulus in the economy, fiscal stimulus. So many say that actually it is a temporary blessing for the Russian economy, but also its curse, because once the war is over, you cannot spend as much on something imaginary. So of course, just like other autocracies, Russia likes to invent, you know, huge, enormous infrastructure, state projects, the highest tower in the universe or something, but still, so many believe that actually Russia one of the reasons why Russia is entitled to continue this war for quite a long is because all of its economy switched to the war Putin. And somehow it works for it. Russian economy has never shown this degree of growth for quite a while.
So Russia's increased military spending, as you described, has given the economy kind of a boost, in the short term at least. Are there any other kind of effects that you've seen this wartime economy having on Russian society?
First thing is that the inflation is quite high in Russia, and as a result, the key interest rate of the central bank is high, which makes many businesses unhappy, but it's unavoidable, which is also a sign of the economy being overheated, which the central bank governor repeatedly says. That's one thing. Another interesting thing is that, so we spoke about some people getting richer because of the war, just because they never were able to get as much money as they do now, because they can go and fight the war or they can work in a military production. And I think it's interesting in terms of the wealth redistribution between the different social classes and different regions in Russia, because there was an interesting statistics released recently. I don't remember by whom. It was some independent body based on, I think, the central bank data. So they connected the map of Russia with the volume of deposits and the rate of growth of those deposits, and shown that in certain regions, this rate of growth was way higher than in the others. And they thought, like, what would explain it? And of course, these were either the regions which have military production there, or these are the regions from where more people were conscripted to the army or went there voluntarily. So it's interesting how, like, new middle class is being formed. But again, we shall see how sustainable this new middle class is going to be, because once the war is over, there is no need to pay them. So how will the state navigate this situation?
Are there any other long-term issues that the Russian state will have to address because of its present military economy once the war ends?
And I think it's an open question of what happens when the war is over, because all these big state companies which now produce equipment for the front line, which now produce rockets, which now produce even, I don't know, clothes for the soldiers, they will have to switch somehow. And of course, in the most negative scenario, they will stuck, probably somewhat remaining what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union, because similarly, there were big factories all over former Soviet Union, which were parts of the big mechanism of the Soviet economy, which means they produced not something demanded by the market conditions, but something which was a part of big Soviet mastermind plan. And similarly, many of them, and this is not the only reason, of course, why it happened, but one of them was that simply there was no need in their production in the market economy. So some of them found ways to pivot, and some just disappeared, just stopped the production. They stopped paying salaries and such. They couldn't exist. So probably in some ways it would happen to some of the Russian companies. But at the same time, they might pivot just like the Russian economy pivoted. So for example, Rostec is one of the big state conglomerates which produces, among other things, weapons. And now it hires enormous amounts of people. But also, theoretically speaking, it could switch after the war is over. It could switch to, you know, producing more helicopters. It already produces helicopters, and, you know, there are countries in terrible need of that, such as Iran. So now Russian economy is the economy of a sole purpose, and the purpose is to supply the war. But in general, if we're talking not 5 years, but 20 years, 30 years, I don't think there are examples yet of a successful, fully state-controlled economy. There are countries which exist like this for years, but do we consider it successful or not? That's a big question. So Russia can slide back into this slow growth and decrease in the quality of life. But again, I don't think we're talking catastrophe here. And again, I think the future of post-war Russia, and I know it's obvious, but it will depend more on the outcome of the war, what happens to its territory, to its geography, rather than the economic constraints. Another interesting aspect is the labor force. So Russia is experiencing the labor force shortage, and this is one of the main risks for the economy. Again, it's not the risk of Russian economy simply not functioning tomorrow, but it's the question of the economy being able to grow further. Because simply if everyone is employed, if everyone is working as productive as they can, and Russia is not the most technologically advanced country in the world to just magically increase the productivity of labor, which it has been trying to do for quite a long time, but didn't manage really. So this is a real struggle, and this is something, again, even the state officials admit. So the central bank always mentioned the labor shortage as one of the main risks for the Russian economy. The finance ministry, even Putin sometimes admits that there is such an issue, but in very, very careful terms. So, and the reasons for that are super obvious. So first, if you send people to the front line and they die there, you have less labor force. Then people are sucked up by the military production complex, and military production complex enjoys endless state financing, which means it can offer higher salaries for its workers, which means to compete with them, the businesses also have to offer higher financing. There are other issues related to the war, but indirectly. So Russia also relied heavily on migration from Central Asia. But this started changing, I think, during COVID, just because it got harder to travel, and also that construction was working not at full. And then it expanded during the war, because first the ruble collapsed after the invasion, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which means it got less profitable to work in Russia and send the money back to one's family in Tajikistan. That's one thing. The second thing is that many of the people who came from there to work were conscripted to the Russian army and maybe did not understand in full what happened to them, or maybe they signed a contract without fully understanding them, and it was spreading in the community. So there is this fear and there is this risk, which means this source of the labor is also gone. And then Russia's population is aging and it's dying out. Because now, like, for example, my generation is the generation of the 90s, and it was one of the smallest generations in quite a while because of the economic situation, because of the unpredictability and such, which means we have less children. But another reason for that is that people don't want to have children in the situation of the war, in the situation of uncertainty. Even though the state spends quite a lot of money on stimulating such programs as you know, paying mothers for having a child, supporting them, which is a good thing in vacuum. But still, that's another reason. So there is this combination of factors because of which Russia struggles of the labor force shortage. And also we need to mention that after the mobilization of the last year, it also affected the situation because many young people, men, but also their families, they left Russia because they didn't want to go to the front line. And these were not only, but mostly people with good education, people who used to work in IT sector, who managed to find jobs easily abroad, but also those who added value to the production in the Russian economy. So overall, there is this risk of labor shortage, and I'm quite curious to see how Russia is going to overcome it, because I don't know, whatever could happen, they could start, and there was actually such talk. So the head of FSB has always been always sounded quite chauvinist, and he has never been happy about the amount of migrant workers in Russia. So he has been trying to sell an idea of using forced labor, like during Soviet times, from the prison to, you know, to fill the gap left by these migrant workers. But it has never happened really, but that's one of the opportunities, so we shall see. But overall, it's one of the resources, right? People are one of the resources the economy has, and one can say one of the most important resources. So as one can imagine, if there is a shortage of this resource, it means that the potential of growth is also limited.
Do you think the Kremlin's wartime trading partners that you mentioned earlier, like China and India, are they intended to serve as sort of a temporary stopgap measure, and that once the war ends, Russia will somehow be able to restore previous trade agreements with the West? Or do you think there's potential for these new trade relations to last, even beyond the war?
Rationally speaking, I cannot imagine any Western big shareholders or even countries to return back to trade with Russia, at least with its current political leadership, just because, not only because it's immoral, but also because it's just unreliable. That's one thing. Second thing is that when we talk about things like oil and gas exports, maybe oil is slightly easier to shift, but it's still, when once a contract is signed, it's usually for a long time. And gas contracts are usually for 10, 15 years. So I think Europe is now doing a great job of switching to other resource suppliers. And once it's done, and once money on this pivot is spent, I don't think it just makes sense economically to get back to Russia. I don't know what Russia has to offer. So it's unreliable, and the risk is so high that even cheap price, I don't think it could compensate it. When it comes to the partnership with those non-Western countries, I think these partnerships could last. Why not? But I think it's important to outline and not to paint too rosy a picture here, because again, from a very broad perspective, Russian economy is doing good. But when you go into details and into the dynamics, I don't think the overall trend is promising. So back then to China and India. So I think it's important to outline that Russia becomes a deal taker. So it used to be a deal maker. It used to be able to sometimes dictate, or at least sometime insist on its own terms of those alliances. And now we don't have this luxury. So you probably saw our story on the power of Siberia too in the FT. So Russia is trying really, really hard to get the deal with China on building a second pipeline. So Russia used to sell, as I said, most of its gas to Europe. And the gas used to come from Yamal Peninsula. And now there is basically nowhere to sell this gas. So the only opportunity to sell it is to build another pipeline from the peninsula to China. But in order to build the pipeline, Russia has to strike a deal with China, where China says, okay, we'll agree to buy that amount of gas for that price for the next 10 years or 15 years. But as we reported, China offered very low price and Russia has not agreed to it. And it's funny, actually, I had a blast enjoying how some state media reported our story, where they used it as a proof that Putin is such a strong leader. He didn't accept the unfavorable terms offered by the Chinese side, but actually he doesn't have any option. So the gas is stuck there. It has nowhere else to go, and it will probably never have. Russia will not be able to build LNG technology, and especially where the gas is located. So the only choice is this pipeline, and it can either say no to low price, but it never can say no to the overall project. So now we don't know what exactly the price was, but most likely it wouldn't cover even remotely the cost of the project itself, because otherwise they would agree. So yes, Russia and China have an alliance now, but I don't think this alliance, and again, this is something that Chinese experts say, that Russia used to have much more equal relationship with European countries than with China. With India, it's slightly different, partly given the position of current position of India in the global picture, but still, Russia cannot offer high price on oil for India. So again, the state wants to present it as a huge achievement, and maybe in some ways it is, because somehow they managed to pivot despite of sanctions. But at the same time, what they do is they run around the buyers and beg them to buy at the cheapest price possible. Does it sound like a global leadership, a huge achievement? I don't know. That's one thing. But still, I think these alliances are to last, partly because Russia has zero choice. And no matter how a country now wants to be isolated from the rest of the world, it's simply impossible. And it's specifically impossible for Russia, because, and many journalists have written about it, that Russia does have its own advanced technology. first of all, microchips, which I needed everywhere. FSB needs them for their computers, and oil producers need them for oil refineries. So Russia cannot exist in isolation. And this is why these friendships will last.
So although sanctions haven't necessarily had the devastating effects that economists had previously anticipated, Putin himself has gone so far as to say that Western sanctions have actually strengthened Russia's economy because now they've fostered the growth of domestic industries to produce the products that they previously had relied on importing from the West. Is there any merit to this argument that sanctions have somehow benefited the Russian economy?
So, of course, they're good for certain sectors of the economy. And of course, there are always people and businesses that benefit from it. But overall, it is never good. And it's just basic law of the economy, but also it's basic logic. So say the Russians used to have access to, I don't know, clothes from China, but also to all the Western brands. And now all the Western brands are gone. It's not empty. The shopping malls in Russia are not empty. Some managed to get still those Western clothes through the third countries, but of course at a higher price. Then there is a huge influx of Turkish or Chinese brands. And then there is a boom in Russian production. But then the logical question comes, so why there was no boom before? The reason is that because it's not competitive. So the Russian brands, there are a lot of good Russian clothes brands, but they are so much more expensive for the Russians than their competitor from the West. It's just because the whole prices are rising because it gets more expensive for them to get all the textile, and also they have to pay more to the workers because of the inflation and because of the very low unemployment. But still, so in general, my point is that the consumer who pays for the isolation. So there was quite a lot of good research on that after the so-called counter sanctions, which are the most stupid thing in the world. So probably for those who forgot about it, it was quite spectacular. So once Russia invaded Crimea, there were some sanctions imposed on Russia. And in response to that, Russia introduced so-called counter sanctions, mostly against food and beverages from specific Western countries. And of course, Russian businesses found ways to, you know, to evade the sanctions and get the goods to Russia. There is even the word in Russia, sanktsionych, which means sanctioned goods. So people who used to travel, for example, to Spain from Russia, they would bring back sanktsionychka as cheese or hamon or something like that. And also there were shops selling that, of course, in Moscow, but the prices were insane. But at the same time, a boom in Russian production started. So, of course, a number of Russian internal producers of wine, of cheese specifically, because Russia had no culture of cheese, and now it does produce decent cheeses. And it boomed, and the shelves were somewhat empty for quite a while, and now they're filled with Russian products. So, again, the state uses it as an example of how the limitations are helping the economy. But actually, Russian economists in Rand Hicks, it's a state-affiliated institute, they had a research of how much every Russian, every consumer pays for that. Because again, all these goods are decent, but all of them are more expensive than what the Russians used to get. And because these goods have no competition, they're even more expensive.
Reflecting on everything we talked about so far, what kind of long-term economic and social consequences do you think ordinary Russians can expect to come as a result of the war?
I think people will live in a situation of stagnation for a really long time. And it has been an economic reality in Russia since the invasion of Crimea, but I think the debris of this isolation and also the irreversibility of this isolation is incomparable. And it means that people will have less opportunities in many ways to live better life, to fulfill their potential. And I know these are all abstract terms, but I think in the end of the day, all of the geopolitics come to an individual human being and the well-being of this individual and the ability of this individual to produce important things in quite a short life we have here. So the Russians will live in somewhat like late Soviet Union, probably, or somewhat resembling Iran, rather than North Korea. So it's not a disaster, but also it's not an amazing life, because I often think of my grandparents, especially my grandmas. They, like, one is alive, one is not. So, but they both love to, like, one of their favorite stories has always been about them trying to get something from a shop, you know, how they went to Moscow to queue for 2 days to get a wardrobe. And my grandma was so proud of this wardrobe. And she used to tell the stories, and she was pregnant then, but she went and she queued for 2 days. And then she spent two more days trying to get clothes for the child. There was no clothes, but she got textile to sew something from it. So there is life everywhere. But was it the limit of my grandma's potential to spend her life queuing for wardrobes and clothes for her newborn? Or was there something else she could do at that time, something more productive, something she would do in a freer society? So I think that if we are talking about more mundane things, many people will experience a fall of wages because the war is over, so the soldiers are not paid anymore, and also the military complex doesn't need that many workers anymore. And then many people will, I think, experience struggles with the mortgages, or may experience struggles with the mortgages and the loans they've gotten, because the trend is slightly cooling down, but Russia has an extremely generous subsidized mortgage program where you get a mortgage under a low interest rate, and they say subsidize the difference between the market rate and the subsidized rate, hence the name. So many people who alternatively wouldn't get a mortgage did get a mortgage, and now they're capable of paying for it because they are receiving money from, like, military-related sources. But once the war is over, the loan is still there, but the income is not anymore. And I think the overall picture that the stand base paints, and also this overall numerical picture, which is good, it gives people belief that things are gonna be good forever, which increases their optimism, which is why they get these loans. But this situation is not sustainable. But again, is it going to lead to an enormous social outburst, a protest? We shall see. But again, people in Russia are used to very low, I think, life conditions. They do not expect much from the state. They do not believe they are worth it. And there is this, again, this is something an ordinary Russian, like my grandmother or my grandpa, would say, that, like, the state gives everything for free. We have free education. We have free medical service, which is like partly true because you don't pay when you get there, but also have really high taxes, and the taxes are getting higher. So I think people have very low expectations from the state, which means they're quite resilient for all the turbulence which might happen after the war, and which the state will definitely blame on the global West and the evil NATO and whatever.
What you're describing sounds almost akin to the stagnation of the 70s and 80s under Brezhnev. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's a likely scenario, again, with all the other variables, like geopolitical risks, like the escalation, the outcome of the war put aside, but these are the most important variables, but completely unpredictable.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.